Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tick-tock, tick-tock, the austerity bomb counting down. And while we're focused on waiting for the boom, while our infrastructure's crumbling, jobs are not being created, and the wholesale theft of our nation continues. Big fun, big fun, big fun, and it's the reality is what it is. The corporatists and the anti-government types, they're in the cloakroom, giddy like schoolgirls, happy as can be, popping the champagne. So when it goes boom Friday at just around midnight, mission accomplished. Another opportunity for the banner to come out. Big, big fun. I'm also going to talk about Jack Lew. Yes, Jack Lew was confirmed. And guess what happened today? Stocks surged on Wall Street as the Dow set a new five-year high. Coincidence? I think not. And more on the Medicaid expansion, as it appears another Republican is, well, looking for a way to save face. And also, well, more fun with guns. It is fun watching Americans exercise their right to be stupid. So big fun, can't wait. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. The big news today, unemployment evidently going to be above 6% for at least the next, well, 3 years, maybe more. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke was giving testimony in front of the House Financial Services Committee. And the question was from Pennsylvania State Pennsylvania Representative Michael Fitzpatrick, who said the Fed has indicated it believes long-term unemployment rates will settle around 5.2 or 6%. Bernanke answers, "Yeah, it's our best guess." He said, Fitzpatrick says, "As an understanding, I heard in your testimony earlier, you're predicting the future." He said, when would you say we might get around 6%? And also the American people, they believe natural unemployment is actually much lower than that given what we experienced in the 90s. Maybe your suggestion is how we address that expectation. He said, again, it's hard to predict, but a reasonable guess for 6% would be about 2016. And I look at this and I go, you know, it would be nice if you guys actually did something other than complaining about it. You know, natural unemployment, think about this for a second. In a laissez-faire economy, lower than 6%? I don't know. We've never seen it. Don't know. In a well-managed economy, one where we have smart investment, sound public policy, where the wealth class pays their share, where we have people who are willing to pay their bills, and where we're not constantly holding the nation hostage, maybe we would get there quicker. Maybe if we had full employment policy as the number one aspect of the Fed instead of fighting inflation, maybe if creating jobs was really all that important, maybe we could do something. But what we've got is we've got a Congress who, and I shouldn't even say all of them, I should say the people who are pushing and all giddy about this sequester, the Tea Party types, the radicals, the extremists, the ones out on the fringe, the ones who do hold enough sway because they've got the big political clout because of the moneyed interests that are behind them. Those are the folks who are willing to hold us hostage. If maybe they would spend a little time creating jobs and growing the economy and staying fixated on a deficit number that, well, they're making worse by their recalcitrance, maybe we would get the country moving again. And you look at what's going to happen Friday at midnight, or right about midnight. Boom! The austerity bomb goes. And you're bringing austerity here to the U.S. Full force. And we've been doing it for the last several years. Just doing it incrementally. Oh, under the guise of we're cutting the fat. Cutting the fat. You know those welfare mothers who have to feed those kids. Cutting the fat. You know, those programs that help the disabled. You know, cutting the fat. Those social programs that help the most vulnerable of the most vulnerable in the state. You know, cutting the fat. That health insurance for low-wage workers. You know, cutting the fat. That health insurance for children. You know, the fat. Chop, chop. We've been doing this for the last several years. Under the guise of there's an office, and we know where it is. It's a gold door. And behind the gold door with the platinum plaque of waste, fraud, and abuse, there's a big giant pit where there's someone with a titanium shovel who's shoveling in our hard-earned tax dollars into a big open pit of flames. That's what the Tea Party has attempted and done a pretty successful job of telling us is going on. When the reality is what's happened is that giant shovel isn't shoveling the money into a fire pit. It's shoveling it into offshore accounts. It's shoveling it into tax havens where the billionaires are pocketing all of it. Last year, $40 billion the states lost because of tax havens. $40 billion, enough money to pay for all of the firefighting in the entire country. And you look at the austerity bomb that's about ready to go off, and it's already gone off. Look, the reality is we've been slashing public investment for generations. We've been slashing spending on roads and bridges, slashing investment in education and healthcare and all. We've been doing this for a couple of generations now. It's just now at critical mass. And Scarnati, the senator over here in Pennsylvania, was right. You know, we cut through the so-called fat, cut through the muscle, into the bone, and now, how do you cut anything else with having any reasonable amount of compassion? The answer is you cannot. And this latest austerity bomb, the Congressional Budget Office says it's going to cost us about 0.6% off of our economic growth and could result in more than 700,000 more jobs being lost. So you add that to the 700,000 jobs we've lost because of austerity. You know, I gotta cut those state workers and those teachers and those cops. Gotta get rid of them. Cut, cut, cut. And you know what that cut, cut, cut has done? I'm sure you didn't see the story because most of the mainstream press didn't pick it up. Up in the northeast here, up in the northeast part of Pennsylvania, there was a 34-year-old corrections officer, a guy named Eric Williams, who was doing his job, been there less than 2 years working in a high security federal prison, beaten and fatally stabbed. Why? Because he was alone. He was putting the inmates in for the night alone. And you know what this is? This is austerity. This is what austerity does. When you've got, and this is what's infuriating to me, because I hear the right wing, I hear the T-twits going, well, you know, it's only 3%. You know, it's only 3%. You could really, if you wanted to, you could cut that 3%. Everybody could cut just 3 cents. It's only 3 pennies. Tell that to the family of this guy. Tell them to the family that he's not coming home to. And why is it? More cuts. And in fact, the union that represents the guards up there, the corrections officers, had just recently sent a letter saying, hey, we're in trouble. And if you start furloughing people, you start laying people off, you start getting rid of them, we're in big trouble. This sequester, this austerity bomb that's about to go off Friday around midnight, it's going to cost the Bureau of Prisons about $338 million from the budget that's already been cut over the year. I know, no, in real dollars it went up. You know that, it went up a dollar. It's more than it was last year by 27 cents. What that's going to mean, think about this for a second. Put yourself in the shoes of these corrections officers. Think about this guy. Think about this Eric Williams, 34-year-old man. Think about him for a second. You're talking about cutting 12 days for all of the employees in the agency. 12 days of furloughs for all employees. What's that going to mean to the next guy who's got to put those prisoners away? What's that going to mean for the guy walking the levels? Does it mean he's going to be by himself? Does it mean where they had three, they only have two? Put yourself in that situation. And then ask yourself, you know, it's only 3 cents. It's just 3 cents. You could cut 3 cents. Tell that to the family. And these things have very real consequences. And I've spent time watching the fake news on Fox. I've spent time listening to the radical right media. And they're playing it down. Oh, the president's just being alarmist. Panic. President Panic, they call him, for coming out and saying, hey, look, this is what's being cut. This is what it means. This is who it affects. That's somehow in the radical right world, that is President Panic actually informing people of what's going to happen. Here are the consequences for their inaction. Here are their consequences of them failing on a repeated number of times to do their job. These are the consequences. And oh, by the way, these are the consequences they imposed upon themselves. And I know, oh, but Rick, the president, hey, the president did this. All laws come from Congress. Budgets come, the power of the purse, right? We've heard this. Congress. This self-imposed crisis? Congress. This manufactured nonsense? Congress. Put blame where blame is due. And understand that the reason that this has happened is because we got a number of very radical people who say, we're not going to pay our bills unless you give massive concessions, unless you fundamentally, systematically destroy all of the institutions that made this country great. And, you know, I think back to my grandfather's generation, and I can't get the Eisenhower quote out of my head. You know, anyone who would be against labor unions or unemployment or Social Security or the Farm Bill, they wouldn't be heard from. Their numbers are negligible and they're stupid. The sad reality is stupid's running things. And the sad thing is, stupid isn't even as thoughtful as Forrest Gump, who people said was stupid. I want Forrest Gump to run our Congress. At least he was somewhat thoughtful. These are people who do not think about the consequences because they despise every bit of what we the people have built. These are people who despise this nation. They're not conservatives. I actually have respect for conservatives. These aren't conservatives. These are con artists. And it's that simple. And it just infuriates me when I see this go on. Angering on so many levels. Going to take a quick break. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts on the sequester? Back after this.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Just days ahead of the $85 billion in automatic federal spending cuts that begin to kick in, labor unions, progressives, and Democrats are arguing for a more intelligent, targeted effort to balance revenues and government spending. One of the first groups of people to really feel the sequester pain will be long-term unemployed workers, who will take a hit to their already inadequate unemployment checks. The biggest ripple effect will come from furloughed federal workers. As the Friday sequester deadline looms, Simpson Bowles has once again come up with a budget-cutting plan that they are trying to spin as balanced. But the plan that Erskine Bowles and former Senator Alan Simpson are advocating is a plan that, according to the AFL-CIO, tells working people to drop dead. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the commission that these two headed in 2010 pushed a budget blueprint that cut tax rates for corporations and the richest Americans while cutting Social Security benefits, shifting Medicare costs to individuals, taxed health insurance benefits, and cut federal worker pay benefits and jobs. The updated Simpson-Bowles plan, Trumka says, once again proposes cutting taxes for corporations and the rich, and pays for it by cutting Social Security cost of living increases, taxing health benefits, and cutting federal employee health and retirement benefits. The AFL-CIO says for working people and our nation, the latest Simpson-Bowles plan is dead on arrival. Latino organizations have joined a global boycott against one of the world's largest hotel chains. Jesse Russell reports.
A boycott against Hyatt Hotels expanded this week with three major Hispanic civil rights groups pledging their support. The National Council of La Raza, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement have all pledged to not hold conventions or other special events at Hyatt Hotels that are being targeted by the boycott. The boycott is being led by Unite Here over allegations by workers of mistreatment, intimidation, and unsafe working conditions. The union claims that the global boycott, which was launched in July of 2012, has cost the company more than $27 million in lost business. Unite Here is asking the chain to adopt recommendations made by the U.S. government that would reduce the daily strain on housekeepers, to allow non-union Hyatt hotels to organize, and to sign off on a contract for thousands of workers, many of whom have been working without a contract for 3 years. Other organizations that have already pledged support for the boycott include the NFL Players Association, the National Organization of Women, Interfaith Worker Justice, and others.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW. To keep labor news on the air, join the Solidarity Circle at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us, because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education like better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
See, right there, perfect example, party is stupid. It doesn't get any simpler than that. That's a Pennsylvania state representative, a Republican. We took it out, but then we put it all right back. You believe that, right? No. Don't believe it at all, because I know you didn't. It's nice that you believe it. It's cute that you believe it. Not true at all, though. Sad, sad stuff. Anyway, this weekend, the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit, the largest gathering of progressives in Pennsylvania, activists from around the state going to come to Harrisburg, going to be at the Harrisburg Hilton on the 1st and 2nd, Friday and Saturday, for their summit. David Cobb, a national spokesperson for Move to Amend, he's going to be here talking about the need to amend the U.S. Constitution to define persons as human beings. And I can't even believe that we have to go through that. That it should just be implicit in the language, but what's gone on is, well, we've had the well-heeled over the years who've said, well, you know, corporations are people. In fact, we had a presidential candidate who ran around saying, yes, corporations are people, my friend. Also, Raul Gajalva, the Democratic congressman from Arizona, going to be here to bring a word from the Progressive Caucus in Congress and a whole bunch of other folks. And Friday night protest music sing-along going to be happening at the Cornerstone Coffee House in Camp Hill, 2133 Market Street, 7:30 to 10 p.m., put on by the good folks at 100,000 Poets and Musicians for Change. So looking forward to being at both of those events. Hope to see you, hope to see everyone there. Looking forward to it. You know, I go back to this story of this prison guard, and so much of this is just plain wrong. You know, I remember, you know, as a young guy, you know, fresh out of college, looking for my first job, I end up taking a job as a security guard. Swore I would never do it again. Have the utmost respect for security officers in the dangerous positions that they're put in for virtually no pay. And I got out of it quickly because there was no career there. That's why I'm glad to see around the country they're starting to unionize and say, you know what, we do a valuable service in protecting your private property. It always blew my mind. Blew my mind that here I was making just minimum wage, a couple of pennies above in some places, and you're guarding multi-billion dollar assets. It's really a struggle to understand and to comprehend. And part of me always thought it was, well, they just need the insurance rates. There's a warm body here, you know. But I think about the dangerous situations I was put in. And I go, you know, it's just insane. And I look at this corrections officer. This is tough, dangerous work. And at every opportunity, what do we hear from the radical right? We need to freeze their pay. In fact, their pay has been frozen for the last 5 years for the most part. Because, well, we've had all these pay freezes, right? Now they want a 10% across the board cut. I've heard all kind of nonsense. These are the people who lock up and this guy worked in a high security facility. This isn't the place that Jerry Sandusky's going. What this guy's worried about, these people are worried about getting hit with, not something Jerry Sandusky's going to throw. These are violent criminals. These are the people who need to be locked up. And what do? Well, cut. More austerity, Bob. And I think about this often. We should be advocating for more people guarding these prisoners. If we're going to lock up these violent criminals, why do we put these folks in such harm's way? And the advocates should be going, look, what we need to be doing is we need to be bringing in not private contractors who are skimming tons of millions and billions of dollars out of the prison money that we're spending, because we're spending a ton of money on locking people up. And where does it go? Well, it goes a lot of it to profit. I gotta make a good profit. I mean, think about the things that we've privatized. Think about this for a while. I mean, the core functions of government, one of the core functions is, in my view, is the justice system. We're outsourcing the end result of the justice system. And then we're surprised, like up near Scranton, up that way, where they had the cash for kids nonsense going on. Where the judges were getting kickbacks from the for-profit kiddie prisons just to give out these long sentences. It's this whole incestuous relationship that, you know, things we should be doing for ourselves. Yes, it's a cost. It's a cost to our society. Every dollar we spend on prisons, we're not spending on education. We're not spending on infrastructure. We're not spending on our kids, and we're not spending on our future. We're spending that prison dollar because of the failures of leadership of the past. That's why. And then we decide, well, we're going to cut the budgets. We're going to come up with this austerity bomb. We're going to come up with this opportunity that, well, you know, it's only 3 cents, right? It's just 3 cents. You could cut 3 cents. I've heard that so many times. You could cut 3 cents if you really wanted to. And I think back to my childhood. And I talk about this often because it really is who I am. I remember going to the cupboards. I remember going to the refrigerator. And there being nothing. Nothing there. Comprehend that for a second. Because I am so grateful that my kids to this point have never seen that moment. Where there is nothing in the refrigerator. maybe a pitcher of water. There's no milk, there's no bread, there's no cereal. Everything's gone. You are at that end of the margin. And now they're saying, well, you know, you could cut 3 cents if you really wanted to. And people like me, people like my mother when I was a kid, those are the people that we're trying mightily. If you look at what the radical right has put forth, you look at the Paul Ryans, you look at the Romney budgets, you look at the things that they've put forth, the discussions that they're having, I'm the one that they wanted to foot the bill because I didn't have a voice. How do you get 3 cents out of nothing? How do you go after that welfare mother? Because that's who we're balancing the budget on the back of. That's what they want to do. That's what Corbett's done. That's what a lot of these governors across the state are doing. And that's what they want to do on the national level. We are literally going to be taking food out of the mouths of children to make sure that multinational corporations have just a little more. And their appetite is insatiable. It never ends. You know, they say, well, if we give more to the job creators, we give more upward, things will be better. They'll create jobs. They know what to do with the money. So if we take it away from these kids, take it away from health care for low-wage workers, take it away from seniors who need it to survive, because, hey, what we need to do is we need to lengthen the time it takes you to get the Social Security and Medicare and, oh, that chain CPI so we can cut the benefits. Before we start taking food out of the mouths of children, before we start kicking my grandmother down the steps, before we start harming the least among us, before we kick a guy when he's down, before we go and harm those who have been harmed, don't you think, just from a rational standpoint, and I know it's easy to look down and say, ah, well, that guy's lazy, oh, that guy won't work, and I know it's easy to point fingers downward. But the reality is, folks, it's not the folks pulling you down, it's the people pushing you down. Andy sent me an email during the break. He said, you know, you just hit it out of the park. Stupid is running things. They don't want government to function or have any ability to uplift the working class. The weaker the government, the stronger the corporations to fill the void. You nailed it. And look, just like I said, you know, earlier on, Jack Lew in, stock market up. Seems like a correlation. Wall Street is happy. And as long as Wall Street is happy, and as long as we're feeding the monster, as long as we're feeding that insatiable appetite, everything will be fine. Sacrifice your future for the benefit of today. Sad, sad stuff. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're a proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Get ready for the rapture. Not the religious kind, but a financial rapture being promised to us by the Holy Spirits of Silicon Valley. Actually, making a financial killing is the religion of the Valleyites. And top techies there are currently in a quasi-religious swoon over what they prophesize to be the next big thing for America. Ready for what they're offering as our economic salvation? Online gambling. Hallelujah! Multi-billions of dollars, they exult, will flow like manna from heaven as everyday gambling sweeps across the land through our iPads and even our cell phones. Gambling is to be as simple as buying an e-book, they brag. No need to go to a casino or anywhere for that matter. You'll have the convenience of placing bets right from the comfort of your own lazy boy while enjoying the whole experience with your, quote, virtual friends. Oh, nice. Virtual, as in not actual. Gosh, I hope you are as ecstatic about this as I am. Ecstatic or not, here it comes. With visions of new tax revenue flowing a mighty river from the munificent gods of mass online wagering, Delaware, Nevada, and New Jersey are already tweaking their laws in a rush to bring this effervescent industry streaming into the lives of their residents. Meanwhile, top siliconers from Amazon, Apple, and Google are excitedly investing in the exuberance of this phenomena. Everybody, says the co-founder of MySpace, is really anticipating this becoming a huge business. The game maker Zynga has jumped out front with an ad promoting its first online betting game, urging everyone to, quote, live the dream. This is Jim Hightower saying, notice the proliferation of such fuzzy concepts as exuberance, anticipation, and dream? Is anything about this prophecy of a new industry real, or are they just conjuring up another speculative bubble?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come tumbling down. The walls come tumbling, tumbling. The walls come tumbling, tumbling down.
Well, Randall had an interesting thought. He sent me an email during the break, said this political theater is being played out reminds me of good cop, bad cop. Can these Republicans really be this over the top? Could Governor Romney have been any worse of a presidential candidate? I'm sure he probably could have. He says, so no more good party, bad party. He says, vote third party. I wish that were possible. I would love to see some rational, reasonable Republicans take their party back from the extremists and the people who have continually brought us these hostage crises. And, you know, it's, as we talked about earlier, the deadly consequences of this. And like I said, just Monday night, there was a corrections officer up in the northeast part of Pennsylvania murdered on the job because he was by himself. Had we adequately funded that, had there been someone else there with him, would that have happened? Would his family have him at home tonight? That's the question we're going to have to answer. I've got our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, on the line. Irwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here, Rick.
You know, I look at this, the ticking bomb, the austerity bomb, tick, 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 coming down to the last minutes. I guess it's Friday around midnight. The bomb that they've created is about ready to go off. And I look at this story, this corrections officer up north, and I got to tell you, is it going to take more of this?
Well, I'm on the show tonight with a broken heart because of that correction officer and his family who doesn't have him tonight. And everybody needs to recognize, realize, process, and understand that sequestration was never, ever intended to be a policy. It was intended to be an incentive to create policy. And now we are having people dying trying to earn a living because a minority of the Congress of the United States that speaks, according to every single poll we see, for virtually no one but itself, has decided to impose its tyranny on the rest of us. This is a sad day and a sad week and a sad time for a great country.
And I look at this and I go, you know, this, again, another one of these manufactured, self-created crisis for what aim? And the only thing I can actually come up with is it's all about destroying our government. It's all about getting people to throw up their hands and say, see, it doesn't work. It's broken. We need radical change. We need to bring in, da-da-da, the corporations.
Well, we had an object lesson in that today that probably went by all but unnoticed by most people, because most people don't do these silly things that I do because of what I do for a living. Most people don't watch what happens in the courts. But today there was an oral argument in the Supreme Court of the United States, a case called Shelby versus Holder, brought by the state of Alabama, challenging the Voting Rights Act of 1964, the law that we had to pass in order to assure that 100 years after the Civil War, people of color would have the right to actually vote, would write to their franchise that was guaranteed to them by the 15th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, one of the three so-called Civil War amendments. And no less than Mr. Justice Antonin Scalia, from the bench, in questioning the lawyers seeking to protect the validity and the integrity of the Voting Rights Act of the United States of America, a law that most recently was readopted by the Congress, unanimously by the Senate, a vote of 98-0 in the U.S. Senate, and with only 33 negative votes out of 435 in the U.S. House. And Mr. Justice Scalia, in questioning one of the lawyers, said, and I quote, "This is not the kind of question you can leave to Congress." Now, this wasn't just some nutcase or some entertainer like Rush Limbaugh. This was a lifetime appointee, Supreme Court Justice of the United States of America, uttering these words, not in 1863, but in 2013. And so, yeah, he's gone a step further. Not only should the Congress engage in self-destructive conduct, but we can't leave these important questions about our rights to the Congress. Now, part of the reason that's pretty intriguing, as well as pretty shocking, is that the Voting Rights Act was passed as an implementation of the 15th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. There are only three amendments to the Constitution of the United States that have language that says that the Congress shall have the power to adopt legislation to implement the intent of those amendments.
Right.
It's the 15th Amendment, which confers a guarantee of voting rights on people based upon their race, that they cannot be discriminated against on the basis of their race or their color. The 19th Amendment has the same implementing language for Congress. The 19th Amendment, of course, confers voting rights on women. And the 26th Amendment, that's the amendment that says that 18 to 21-year-olds acquire the right to vote in the United States, and that has the same language. Those three amendments are the only ones that have that kind of language. Remember, in our system of government, of course, that the Constitution is the grant of rights from the people to the government, not the reverse.
Right.
And the rest of the Constitution, the legislative article of the Constitution, Article 2, has a list of things that the Congress may not do. But the 15th Amendment, the 19th Amendment, and the 26th Amendment each contain language that say that these things, all of which are bound up in voting rights, are so important that we, the people, have given the Congress the duty, not really the power, the duty to adopt laws to implement them. And the Supreme Court of the United States, in the person of Justice Scalia, from the bench today announces that the will of a unanimous Senate, of a virtually unanimous House of Representatives, the will of the people of the United States must be suppressed and ignored, because these are kinds of questions that are too important for the Congress to take up. So I'm a little sad today.
Yeah, I can imagine. So the question then becomes is, if that's under question, are the others under question as well? I mean, the rights of women to vote and the rights of 18 to 21-year-olds, is that in question now too?
Well, clearly in the mind of Justice Scalia, who has spent years characterizing himself as a strict constructionist, now believes that the very words of our Constitution, because every one of those amendments is the Constitution itself, and the words that say the Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation don't count, according to Scalia.
That's interesting. I mean, you look at this and you go, then who does?
Well, apparently the corporations and the justice. We have a government that has three branches, Rick.
I understand that, but if he's saying Congress doesn't, who does then?
Well, we have spent every single session of every single government agency from 1787 until today knowing that the executive branch and the legislative branch and the judicial branch were co-equal branches of government, that they performed checks and balances on one another. You remember that from ninth grade civics class?
Absolutely.
Well, today, Justice Scalia at least has said there's no check and balance on this, even when the people have spoken and given Congress the power to do something specific in the Constitution. Scalia supplants his own judgment, that so-called strict constructionist who looks at the language of the Constitution that confers duties on the Congress and says, this is too big of a question, too important a question for the Congress to deal with.
Well,
I guess he's right and the people are wrong.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, I've heard him being referred to as someone who believes in the original intent, whatever that means, the original intent of the Constitution. Does this fit into that frame then? I mean, if he is someone who you say, well, he believes in the original intent, does this fit into that frame?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question you raise, because Scalia talks about the original intent, the intent of the framers, very frequently, and he does it about the people who were writing the Constitution in 1787. And it's hard for us to know what they had in mind in 1787. At this point in history, 200 plus odd years later, the only way we can glean the original intent of the framers is by reading things that are contemporaneous and trying to hope, if you will, that our present understandings of the language that we use and speak can be set aside and we can somehow morph ourselves back to 1787 to understand those words. But intriguingly enough, the Voting Rights Act was adopted in a period of time during which the vast majority of us lived. Okay? I remember 1964. I remember a man who I am so proud to call my friend in 1964, John Lewis, leading a march from Selma to Montgomery and being beaten nearly to death at a time when in Montgomery, Alabama, of the 14,000 African American adults in that community, 300 were registered to vote. Today, John Lewis is a United States congressman. And the Voting Rights Act was passed at the insistence of no less than President Lyndon Johnson, because President Johnson, a Southerner, a Texan, recognized that he and every other member of the Congress had raised their right hand and sworn to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution, as amended by the 15th Amendment, conferred the right to vote and guaranteed it to people of color. And John Lewis, now Congressman John Lewis, nearly died, and many other people did die, attempting to march and speak out and exercise their right to register, to vote, and to vote. And today, Antonin Scalia says that this is too significant an issue for the people to have delegated to the Congress. He's delegated it to himself. And this, of course, comes only months after we were in court right here in Pennsylvania fighting about a phony voter ID law that was aimed in exact fashion to strip people of color, to strip minorities, to strip poor people of their right to vote.
The case that was before the Supreme Court, this Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder, what was the issue at question?
The issue in question has to do with what's known as Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act of 1964. Section 5, through congressional action, designated that certain states that had a demonstrated and historic pattern of thwarting, impeding, impinging, smothering voting rights for people of color through various methodologies like a poll tax, like a literacy test that would have questions like, your test, Mr. Smith, is to name all of my sister's children.
Or name all 435 members of Congress.
Name
in alphabetical order.
In alphabetical order, backwards. So states that did those kinds of things, states that had a habit of moving polling places without announcing them to the general population, fall within the ambit of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And it says in Section 5 that those states that have had this dramatic and historic consistent pattern excuse me, could not amend their local voting laws without preclearance by either United States Department of Justice or by a panel of federal judges. Over the years since the passage of the law, some states that had been considered so-called Section 5 states have, through their wonderful conduct and attention to this issue, been removed from the list. And still other states have been added to the list. They tend generally to be states from the Old South, but not always. And as recently as a few months ago, when we were arguing the voter ID case in Pennsylvania, there was a parallel case being developed by the U.S. Justice Department, and Pennsylvania is not a Section 5 state, so there was no requirement of preclearance. And the difference, of course, is that in states where preclearance is not required, the only rights that people have are rights to sue after the fact when they have been actually denied their voting right and the outcome of the elections have already been skewed because of that, as opposed to getting this preclearance that would protect people from losing their rights before an election. And I was arguing then that it may well be that Section 5 does indeed need to be changed. And the change should be not that it applies to some states, but it should apply to every state.
Absolutely.
Because we see what's happened in places like Pennsylvania,
Ohio,
like Indiana, like Ohio, like Michigan, like Wisconsin, none of which are so-called Section 5 states. So what's being challenged in Shelby is the efficacy and the applicability, and indeed now because of the utterances of Mr. Justice Antonin Scalia, the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And the lawyer representing Alabama that brought this case, the lawyer representing Shelby, asserted in court today, among other things, that Section 5 is no longer needed because we have transcended that.
And I've actually heard the argument that by continuing this, it's making it worse. We're actually perpetuating the racial issue. And I think it was Scalia who says that it's a perpetuation of racial entitlement is what I think he said.
Well, Scalia said that it is specifically, from his perspective, a perpetuation of racial entitlement. when I first saw the tweets about that coming out of the court today, I thought somebody was kidding. I really thought it was some sick joke. But it wasn't. This was a justice of the Supreme Court of the United States saying exactly those words. And then he went on to say, as I understand it from what I saw in the press reports, by God, there are some congressional districts that are almost guaranteed to be black. Saying it in a way as if, boy, they're coming to get your country. And I can hardly believe my eyes. I can't imagine that I have seen this day in American jurisprudence. It is thunderous. It is amazing. It is shocking. And it is troubling. And the reason why is that we have apparently, in this short time, reached a point where the Scalias of the world feel that it is not merely safe, but it's appropriate to say in public what they used to just whisper in their country clubs.
Yep.
And while Mr. Justice Roberts was not nearly as, nearly as much of a lightning rod, nearly as obnoxious, he was equally clear in his questioning about what he thought of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And I keep on saying this. I don't mean to overemphasize this. I don't want to be the harbinger, as it were, of gloom and doom. But this is a particularly sad day in American jurisprudence. And it's a sad day in American history. Because if a justice of the Supreme Court, a member of a co-equal branch of government, has the right to determine what another co-equal branch may do with a grant of specific authority from the people to that branch of government, and that he has the right to substitute his judgment for the judgment of the people, we have traveled a path that has gotten us to be not very different than the former Soviet Union.
Now, is there any way to get him off of the Supreme Court? I mean, is there any, because at a certain point, haven't you gone beyond sanity, beyond rational thought, beyond authority, something?
Well, going beyond sanity, rational thought, and authority standing alone is not grounds to remove somebody from office. Grounds to remove somebody from office, also found in that same Constitution, are in articles of impeachment. And that is for high crimes and misdemeanors.
Right.
And what Scalia has proposed is offensive, is obnoxious, and it is a just 180-degree turn from the progress we have made as a country, much of it in my lifetime. But it's neither a high crime nor a misdemeanor.
What are the chances of this going the wrong way? I mean, it would obviously probably be a 5-4 decision. If it did go Scalia's way, what are the chances of that?
Well, the way the court is currently composed, Mr. Justice Kennedy is holding this in the balance, and I wasn't jumping for joy over the questions I heard attributed to Justice Kennedy today either. It's a rough road to hoe. And
so if I go back to the things I've said about this sequestration, they've created this bomb and they want it to go boom. It's going to harm thousands and millions of people in this country. It's going to harm poor people. It's going to harm folks who work in prisons and folks who work for the FAA. It's going to harm a lot of folks. It's going to harm the economy. At some point, don't we don't we take to the streets? Don't the people harmed by these decisions organize and get out and as I've been saying, make the Tea Party look like a bunch of pikers?
Well, sign me up, buddy. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to march. I'm ready to lead. I'm ready to follow. We are perilously close to a time that I haven't seen in my lifetime, to a time like we had in the 1930s during the midst of the Depression, where people had recognized that they have precious little to lose. Understand that while the people of whom you speak are the first and the most rapid victims of this government shutdown by default, they're not the only ones. Rich people are going to lose too, you know, and they're going to lose their safety when there are no police, and they're going to lose their homes when there are no firefighters, and they're going to lose their children when the way people have to earn a living is by dealing drugs and engaging in crime, and they're going to lose their fortunes.
Gated communities with their private police force and their private fire departments, and they've figured out how to have a separate world from the rest of us, because we have given them so much. We've allowed them to maintain outside of the rest of society, and I think we need to go back, as Paul Krugman said, and have that great compression again, to where we all live in this country, not as two Americas, but as one.
Well, I think that that's quite right, but remember, that's exactly what the elite thought in Johannesburg, South Africa, 30 years ago. And they lived in their gated communities, and they had their private police forces, and everybody had a gun. And people of color lived in the township, what they referred to as the townships. And ultimately, those people, those very rich people, also lost. And they lost everything, and they ran from their country. Now, yeah, they were able to run and others weren't. But often they ran with just what they had on their backs. But I like Paul Krugman's solution infinitely better. But just in the last couple of days, we have seen the statistics again, and the income gap continues to widen. And the 99% lost ground of what little they had to the 1%.
Again.
And here in Pennsylvania, yesterday, Corbett finally fessed up and admitted from his perspective, that his pension slashing plan for public employees, for those very cops and firefighters and our school teachers and the other first responders and our dedicated road workers, highway workers, public sector employees of all sorts, will lose $12 billion, that's with a B, dollars of their deferred income.
And that's something we're going to have to pick up the next time we have you back on the program, or when I've got to take a break here at top of the hour.
Gotcha.
I appreciate it, and I got to tell you, sad, sad day. Thank you for bringing us up to speed on that.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks to our listeners, too.
Quick break, back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Just days ahead of the $85 billion in automatic federal spending cuts that begin to kick in, labor unions, progressives, and Democrats are arguing for a more intelligent, targeted effort to balance revenues and government spending.
One of the first groups of people to really feel the sequester pain will be long-term unemployed workers, who will take a hit to their already inadequate unemployment checks. The biggest ripple effect will come from furloughed federal workers. As the Friday sequester deadline looms, Simpson Bowles has once again come up with a budget-cutting plan that they are trying to spin as balanced. But the plan that Erskine Bowles and former Senator Alan Simpson are advocating is a plan that, according to the AFL-CIO, tells working people to drop dead. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the commission that these two headed in 2010 pushed a budget blueprint that cut tax rates for corporations and the richest Americans while cutting Social Security benefits, shifting Medicare costs to individuals, taxed health insurance benefits, and cut federal worker pay benefits and jobs. The updated Simpson-Bowles plan, Trumka says, once again proposes cutting taxes for corporations and the rich and pays for it by cutting Social Security cost of living increases, taxing health benefits, and cutting federal employee health and retirement benefits. The AFL-CIO says for working people and our nation, the latest Simpson-Bowles plan is dead on arrival. Latino organizations have joined a global boycott against one of the world's largest hotel chains. Jesse Russell reports.
A boycott against Hyatt Hotels expanded this week with three major Hispanic civil rights groups pledging their support. The National Council of La Raza, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement have all pledged to not hold conventions or other special events at Hyatt Hotels that are being targeted by the boycott. The boycott is being led by Unite Here over allegations by workers of mistreatment, intimidation, and unsafe working conditions. The union claims that the global boycott, which was launched in July of 2012, has cost the company more than $27 million in lost business. Unite Here is asking the chain to adopt recommendations made by the U.S. government that would reduce the daily strain on housekeepers, to allow non-union Hyatt hotels to organize, and to sign off on a contract for thousands of workers, many of whom have been working without a contract for 3 years. Other organizations that have already pledged support for the boycott include the NFL Players Association, the National Organization of Women, Interfaith Worker Justice, and others.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW. To keep labor news on the air, join the Solidarity Circle at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize.
Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Big news today out of Harrisburg. The governor says he's going to meet with U.S. Health and Human Service Secretary Kathleen Sebelius because he's got questions. I think he's getting some pressure from other governors around the state going, hey, it's about time we give in on this and we start covering people. I understand here in Pennsylvania, you're talking a potential of covering almost 700,000 adults with this Medicaid expansion. And you look at Christie just over the border there, the 300,000 people he's going to get coverage for. It's the right thing to do. And once we get people covered, guess what? The costs may come down. And once we start doing some smart things to, like, stopping infections and looking at how do we do away with some errors, maybe that brings some costs down as well. So when I came across this book, Beyond the Checklist, What Else Healthcare Can Learn from Aviation Teamwork and Safety, I'm going, well, let's figure this out because it's an interesting link, which is why I've asked the author, Suzanne Gordon, who is the author of some 15 books, also a visiting professor at the University of Maryland's School of Nursing. Suzanne, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, thanks for having me.
I guess the first question I've got, you know, how do you link the healthcare profession with the aviation profession of the 70s?
Aviation used to be very, very dangerous. It used to be much more dangerous to fly an airplane than it is today. And there were all kinds of terrible crashes that occurred mostly because the captain would blow off the first officer wouldn't say anything with sufficient urgency, the flight attendants were afraid to speak up, and they created a safety model called crew resource management that taught people how to share information, solicit information, listen, challenge a captain if he was making a bad decision. And as a result, aviation and flying is safer than it's ever been. And healthcare is not that safe. Going into a hospital, about 100,000 people die, more than that every year from medical errors and injuries, and another 1.5 million probably are very badly harmed. And if the aviation safety model were adapted to healthcare and people were trained to, with the skills to create teams and to work on genuine teams as opposed to acting like intimate strangers engaged in parallel play at the bedside, patients might not experience this, so much harm. So our book argues that there's a model out there that's been flight tested, if you will, that could be adapted to healthcare, but not enough people are listening and looking and really taking it seriously.
Well, I would think they don't want to break down the hierarchy because, you know, you've got these people who have God complexes. And, you know, my grandmother has spent time in and out of the hospitals because she's, you know, she's 84 years old and she's got some health problems. And you talk to some of these doctors and they know. They're going to tell you what they believe. And you go to get a different opinion and they're going to tell you exactly what they believe in. They're kind of far off, and they don't. There's not a lot of communication, in my view. So maybe this isn't a bad idea.
Well, I think it's a very good idea, and captains and pilots used to be pretty much the same way. They were gods in the cockpit. And,
captain of my ship.
Yeah, and they were, I'm the captain, I'm king, don't do anything, don't say anything, don't touch anything, shut up. And now the aviation model is, I'm captain, I'm king, please tell me if you see me making a mistake. So you can be king, you know, you can be the authority. You can still be God if you want, but you got to rule a different way. And nobody's suggesting taking authority away from people. It's whether they have secure or insecure authority, as they say in aviation. And, you know, the captains and the pilots were very, very opposed to this model in the 70s and 80s, in the 80s. When it was presented, they thought it was a communist plot to take away their authority. And now there's, you know, only a rare captain would not do CRM. I mean, it's required. And you saw the result of this 40 years of training and skill building in the flight 1549 when Chesley Sullenberger, who, by the way, did the foreword for our book, landed that flight in the Hudson safely, and that was not divine intervention. It wasn't just the skill of one very skilled aviator, but it was the result of practice and teamwork and communication that had been going on in aviation for many, many years. And that same kind of thing can happen in healthcare if people really take it much more seriously, and particularly if heads of hospitals and other healthcare institutions really begin to look at the kind of communication problems and teamwork failures that lead to a lot of medical errors and injuries.
Yeah, you know, but you know, again, I would imagine one of the pushback moments would be where I'm the one who's responsible. I'm the guy at the top. So, you know, everything's my fault. So I've got to be able to micromanage and control. I can see how there would be some breakdown there.
Oh yeah. And the answer to that is absolutely you're in charge, but you're going to do a better job of being in charge if you consider and invite the input of people who have information and knowledge and skill as well as you. And that's why they call it crew resource management, because the idea is to look at your crew as resources as opposed to competition or people who are trying to erode your authority. And so you do a better job in exercising your authority when you consider the people that you're working with and the information and skill that they have, because in healthcare, everybody around has a lot of a lot to offer. The nurses know a lot. Even a housekeeper may have information that you need to have to keep a patient safe. And people are not soliciting that in healthcare. They don't, but it's a skill. You can learn these skills. And if you don't teach people these skills systematically, then it's not surprising that you're going to have people die or people get unnecessarily injured because people lack the teamwork skills to function well. I mean, what is the hallmark of a team? You know, people don't, the football teams don't go into the NFL without ever practicing together.
True.
Without establishing common goals and knowledge and moves. And in healthcare, people aren't practicing. They're not doing this. And the team may be, you know, a couple of surgeons working together, but what about the nurse, the pharmacist, the physical therapist, et cetera? Those people have to be brought into it. And they have to be, they have to feel that it's safe for them to speak up. And right now, it isn't.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of nurses. With my grandmother, the best care that I've gotten, and I know doctors, they're on a certain level, but the nurses have always been fantastic, and they've always, to me, given the best advice because they're right there. They see in and out. They know my grandmother's case, and just across the board, even with my own experiences. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Suzanne Gordon. She's the author of Beyond the Checklist: What Else Healthcare Can Learn from Aviation, Teamwork, and Safety. And the title, Beyond the Checklist, explain what kind of checklist you're talking about. I know in the book you write that people live by checklists and die without them. Explain that for me.
Well, in aviation, there's a checklist for everything. So, you know, it's sort of like a grocery list, right? Pick up the butter, pick up the milk. You have to... You know, you have a checklist for everything that you're going to do to make sure that people take all the steps if they're dealing either in a routine situation or an emergency. And that is because people forget things. And checklists are critical in aviation, but checklists are only one of the things in the aviation safety model. And many people in healthcare have looked at this concept of checklists and they have adopted that, which is good. Many times they don't follow the checklist, but, for example, in surgery, the surgical checklist or something. But our argument is that the aviation safety model is much more than checklists, and that checklists are embedded in a cultural shift, in a cultural transformation that took this culture of toxic hierarchy. It took this culture of, you know, I call it a who-do-you-think-you-are culture. You know, who do you think you are telling me that there's ice on the wing and that the plane isn't sufficiently de-iced? And it's the same thing in healthcare. And it's not just doctors that do it. It's nurses that do it. It's, you know, lots of people are guardians of this kind of dysfunctional culture. And it took that culture and it transformed it. So we argue that the aviation safety model is important not just because of checklists, but it's a whole lot more than checklists, and that's why we call the book Beyond the Checklist.
Right. You know, are there any examples of this being done? I mean, we live in really a for-profit driven healthcare environment. I mean, the CEOs, the bean counters that are running hospitals, because I don't know that we really have doctors running hospitals anymore. It's all about the bottom line. Is there an argument to be made for your system to be implemented, and are there examples in practice right now?
We give examples of a hospital in Brooklyn, a very large hospital called Maimonides Hospital, that has done institution-wide something approximating what the industry has done in healthcare. We look at some models of interprofessional education that are being promoted in North America as models. So there's some models, and there's definitely hope, and there's a very important team training program that was started by the government, by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and the Department of Defense called Team Steps, and we argue that that needs to be used everywhere. What we argue for really is a model that is systematically implemented and that is recurrently revisited, because you don't transform people's behavior and attitudes and practices by giving them one seminar for a couple of hours. You really have to integrate this into the practice environment, and you have to really revisit it constantly. In aviation, captains go through crew resource management or threat and error management training twice a year. Flight attendants do it once a year. And in healthcare, it's really not happening in that sort of systematic way that is necessary to really change the kind of culture of healthcare.
Yeah, the question that I always have, because I was surprised to find out that, you know, like doctors and nurses have their own vocabulary. They don't speak they speak basically in the same terms, but there are plenty of differences. Is there a way to make that?
This is something most people don't know, that doctors and nurses don't even speak the same language sometimes, because nurses are not sometimes allowed to use certain kinds of medical terminology, like the patient has a UTI, a urinary tract infection, because that's conceptualized as making a diagnosis,
right,
and only doctors can make a diagnosis. So descriptive language is misconceptualized as diagnostic language. And, I mean, how can people communicate and form teams if they don't even speak the same language? If a nurse can't say she's got a UTI, but it has to kind of do some convoluted thing about she has, describe the symptoms rather than give this, diagnosis, which is jealously guarded by physicians. This is an inheritance of centuries of history, but it really needs to be overcome, because if you don't have in healthcare the sort of version of aviation left and right, people don't know what they're talking about, and people can't really communicate with each other, and people have these bizarre patterns of communication that appear to each other as really strange. I mean, Team Steps has really tried to create a common safety language, and that's really very important, and that has to be adopted everywhere.
Right, I'm with you. Where does that last question I've got for you? Where does that have to come from? Does that come from the schools? Does that come from the hospitals? Does that come from the professionals, or does it come from a push from the patients?
It has to come from everywhere. But patients have to be partners in this transformation. But patients are not able to force their healthcare practitioners to function on teams. I mean, I think it's a good thing for us as patients to look out for. To observe whether your doctor, is briefing the nurse. But I think this has to come from hospital management and from the professions and fundamentally from the government, because in aviation we have a Federal Aviation Administration and they make CRM training a requirement. None of this is optional in aviation. And it can't be optional in healthcare if patients are going to survive.
Yeah, I'm with you. But too often, the patient's the last to know and the last to be consulted and the last to be talked. I know last summer I had a fairly serious hospital stay, and boy, it was like pulling teeth getting information out of people. The book, Beyond the Checklist, What Else Healthcare Can Learn from Aviation Teamwork and Safety, by Suzanne Gordon. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com of where you can pick up the book. Suzanne, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, and we have a website, www.beyondthechecklist.com, that people might be interested in.
And we will make sure we get that linked at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Suzanne, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
But all right, just make us be brave, make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Get ready for the rapture. Not the religious kind, but a financial rapture being promised to us by the Holy Spirits of Silicon Valley. Actually, making a financial killing is the religion of the Valleyites, and top techies there are currently in a quasi-religious swoon over what they prophesize to be the next big thing for America. Ready for what they're offering as our economic salvation? Online gambling. Hallelujah! Multibillions of dollars they exalt will flow like manna from heaven as everyday gambling sweeps across the land through our iPads and even our cell phones. Gambling is to be as simple as buying an e-book, they brag. No need to go to a casino or anywhere for that matter. You'll have the convenience of placing bets right from the comfort of your own lazy boy, while enjoying the whole experience with your, quote, virtual friends. Oh, nice. Virtual, as in not actual. Gosh, I hope you are as ecstatic about this as I am. Ecstatic or not, here it comes. With visions of new tax revenue flowing like a mighty river from the munificent gods of mass online wagering, Delaware, Nevada, and New Jersey are already tweaking their laws in a rush to bring this effervescent industry streaming into the lives of their residents. Meanwhile, top siliconers from Amazon, Apple, and Google are excitedly investing in the exuberance of this phenomena. Everybody, says the co-founder of MySpace, is really anticipating this becoming a huge business. The game maker Zynga has jumped out front with an ad promoting its first online betting game, urging everyone to, quote, live the dream. This is Jim Hightower saying, notice the proliferation of such fuzzy concepts as exuberance, anticipation, and dream? Is anything about this prophecy of a new industry real, or are they just conjuring up another speculative bubble?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell we fighting for? Just got time to say your prayer. While you're waiting for the hammer to fall.
Interesting story out of Kansas. Kansas Senate Bill 142, put forth by you-know-who, the radical right wing of the insane party on the right. I'm just going to read it because it's quite amusing. No civil action may be commenced in any court for a claim of wrongful life or wrongful birth, and no damages may be recovered in any civil action for any physical condition of a minor that existed at the time of such minor's birth if the damages sought arise out of a claim that a person's action or omission contributed to such minor's mother not obtaining an abortion. Now this goes to if a woman goes in pregnant, there's a massive birth defect, there's something seriously wrong, and the doctor just decides not to tell you. And you go and you bring this child into the world where you could have had the opportunity to say, you know what, we're going to terminate the pregnancy. What they're saying in Kansas, what this Senate bill would do is, well, hold the hold the doctor harmless. You can't sue him. That's it. Done. And, you know, you look at this and you go, at some point, now other states, I think Arizona has Arizona, the Senate there had passed a law much like this back in 2012. Only there in the Arizona State Senate bill, intentional or gross negligence, you could sue for. But this, you could just say, you know what? I'm not going to tell you. And I think back to a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine who his wife had, and I forget what they called it, but she was pregnant only in the sense that her body was reacting like it was, there was nothing in the uterus. There was, you know, it was growing, but she would have gone through the birthing process and, well, nothing would have, just, you know, tissue, and there was nothing growing. There was no life there. And you go, well, you know, if a doctor says, well, gee, I hope something happens, I'm just not going to tell you right now. I have huge problems with doctors taking liberties of their belief structure, of their ideology, and not passing that information along and not being honest. I mean, this just opens a really, really dangerous door. And, you know, you look at what's going on with this whole, oh, there's a war on religion. Well, you know what? If you've got a problem with that, then don't do that. If you're an OBGYN who's against birth control, you shouldn't be doing it. If you're an OBGYN who's against abortion, don't do it. If you're against handing out, don't do it, but don't tell me that I can't. And this is what's bothering me. We're giving people who say, well, it's against my belief, so you shouldn't be able to do it. Something's seriously wrong. And then we're going to pass laws. I'm waiting for this to pop up here in Pennsylvania. I mean, we've seen all of the insanity, all the right-wing nonsense going across the country. When's it going to come here? I mean, the vaginal ultrasound laws that have gone through, were, to me, I got to be honest, that's government-sponsored rape, if you will, because no woman wants that. Just blows my mind. And this systematic dismantling of our nation is really troublesome. And you know, talking earlier to Irwin about the Voting Rights Act, I mean, that's absolutely just amazing. We can't leave such things to Congress as voting? When did we appoint him? When did we appoint him God? It's the same thing we're doing with doctors. I think Suzanne's got a point in her book. Someone's got to question the hierarchy. Someone's got to be able to say, I think you're a bit off base. And I think back to my, you know, some of the run-ins I've had with doctors who they know, and we're going to tell you. And then you find out, well, that probably wasn't the best way to go. And I think about my grandmother right now who had a heart valve replaced a couple of years ago, where, you know, the last two doctors we went to said it was probably the worst thing that she could have ever had done. But that doctor knew. And I'm not bashing on doctors, but I am bashing on the ones who have that God complex. And, you know, I think Suzanne's got a good idea that should be examined. Sadly, probably not. Anyway, quick break, right back. Stick around.
Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky. China's endangered wild pandas need bamboo to survive. But a study indicates that climate change will kill bamboo off in swaths.
Scientists from Michigan State University and the Chinese Academy of Sciences studied how Earth's changing climate might affect the most common species of bamboo carpeting forest floors in the mountains of northwestern China. The area is prime panda habitat, home to about 275 wild pandas, or about 17% of the remaining wild population.
The scientists studied possible scenarios of climate change. They said even the most optimistic scenarios show that, by the end of the 21st century, bamboo die-offs would cause prime panda habitat to become inhospitable for pandas.
A panda's daily menu consists almost entirely of bamboo leaves, stems, and shoots. And bamboo is a vital part of forest ecosystems, an essential food and shelter for other wildlife as well.
But bamboo has an unusual reproductive cycle. The species studied by these scientists flower and reproduce only every 30 to 35 years. That fact limits the plant's abilities to adapt to changing climate and can spell disaster for a food supply.
The scientists who conducted this study said that looking at the climate's impact on bamboo can help us prepare for the challenges that pandas are likely to face in the future. Today's program was made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
This is the most unfortunate situation that I have seen in a long time in Washington as a result of one or two people who just really were not willing to compromise. They wanted their way. And as a result of them wanting their way, 70,000 construction workers are idle in construction projects around America at airports, and 4,000 FAA employees are not receiving paychecks and haven't received paychecks for more than 10 days.
Oh, that was former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood during the last FAA shutdown, the last hostage crisis of this kind. And, you know, you go and you look at this, how many lives are going to have to be affected? How many people are going to be harmed? How many people are going to be inconvenienced? At some point, I'm of the belief that there's a segment of this population who believes that government should be destroyed. Nothing should be done by we the people. Everything should be done for profit by the handfuls. And any means to destroying what is ours, what we do for ourselves, should be gone forth with. And, you know, all of these games, all of these manufactured crises, all of this stuff meets to that end. And, you know, I can't get the corrections officer from the northeast part of Pennsylvania out of my head. Beaten, murdered, because he was alone in a high security federal prison with prisoners. What's it going to take? And now we're talking about cutting hundreds hundreds of millions of dollars from that budget as well? There's something seriously, seriously wrong. And what's going on? Blaming the president because he's out there telling people what's going on, calling him the president panic. Well, let's find out what's going to go on. What happens when we shut down some of the air traffic control towers? What's going to happen to air flight in the country? Which is why I've asked Don Chapman, air traffic controller and president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, Philadelphia local, NATCA.org, the website. Don, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
So what's going on here? What's going to happen tomorrow just about midnight when they cut the funding? What's going to happen to your members? What's going to happen to us as the flying public?
Well, you know, the biggest thing is we really don't know because we've never had anything like this happen before. So we're going to do something to a system that is fragile as it is, that any piece of it can cause ripple effects throughout the entire national airspace system without any precedent. So that's the first concern. We don't know, to be honest with you, the FAA has not yet made a decision on what it plans to do definitively, but it has put out information that should it have to comply with the pending sequestration cuts, it would have to immediately slice anywhere from 8 to 16% of the controller workforce.
Wow. And that is not good. But you know what? Here's the thing that blows my mind. We hear folks talking about we need to run government like a business. And, you know, I don't know any business that can operate on the kind of uncertainty that we've been operating under for the last couple of years because we've got folks who are hell-bent on destroying our government. There's not a contingency plan for the FAA on random shutdowns, is there?
No, not at all. As I said, this is unprecedented. And, you know, it would be pragmatic in a situation like this to have the ability to prepare, to test, because the system is unpredictable in dramatic cuts like this. They don't happen as a matter of planning. So
nor should they. Nor should they, Don. I mean, the thing here is this should never happen. This kind of uncertainty, this kind of insanity should never be allowed to happen. This is what you guys do as a part of the commons of our country. It's what we do for ourselves to make sure we can get from place to place safely. And now we're throwing a wrench into the middle of that, uncertainty into the middle of that, and danger into the middle of that.
Yeah, the air traffic system is definitely not the place that you want to make cuts. It's the place that you want to avoid cuts, if at all possible, because of the very nature of it and the unpredictability of what happens when you don't have prior planning and prior testing.
Let's say we do the, what did you say, 8 to 12% cuts?
Yeah, because right now what they're telling us, the FAA administrator is saying, in order to meet the budget cuts of $430 million to the FAA operations budget, they would have to furlough every air traffic controller, not to mention the support employees, the technicians, and all the other pieces of the system for anywhere between 11 days to 22 days.
And what kind of period?
Over the remainder of the fiscal year, between now and the end of September.
And what kind of pay cut would that mean? Let's say you took 22 days. They stole 22 days of pay from you. What's that? Was that 15%?
Yeah, roughly, because you're looking at approximately, as I said, if it's 11 days per controller, for the rest of the fiscal year, that's about 7% of our workforce in Philadelphia I'm speaking of. If it's 22 days, and you're looking at about, 7, 8 to 16% at the top end, and that's the worst case scenario that they're predicting right now. So, we're planning for the worst case scenario, and our job is always to keep the public safe, no matter what. A controller can only work a finite number of airplanes. So,
right.
What will happen is we will adjust the system in order to maintain the safety of the flying public, which means reducing the system capacity, which means long lines, inconvenience, the potential for delays,
higher
and all
prices.
The things people shouldn't have to deal with.
Not to mention higher prices, the basic laws of supply and demand. If there are less flights, more people vying for them, ticket prices, I think will go up, no?
Well, that's an unknown. That's up to the airlines. But, it not only puts, that doesn't only have a direct effect on us. It has a direct effect on the livelihood of the people that depend on the airline industry for their jobs as well, because it puts them in financial jeopardy because they can't sustain their current business model, which puts all the people that work here and the mechanics, the pilots, and all of those people at risk as well.
So we're talking a spiraling down of the economy of epic proportions, really. I mean, you're talking about not just the controllers being out of work, but all down the chain. And I look at places like Harrisburg, which I understand, someone told me yesterday that they would be closing Harrisburg at certain times. And what happens to getting in and out of there? What happens to that workforce? And where do those planes go? Is there talk of closing airports because you don't have people to man the towers, especially in those places where at night there's only one controller?
Yes, the agency issued a list of control towers that would be closed down in the event. It potentially. I do need to qualify that they haven't definitively said it, but they have issued a large list of control towers, mostly in rural areas, and there are places like Harrisburg that are smaller cities that depend heavily on, you know, the airport, and those facilities would be potentially closed down to, you know, meet the budget cuts that are required. And to more directly to your question, what happens in those cases is the other facilities, which are now having their staffing cut, the overlying facilities have to pick up that traffic. And not only do they have to provide the service to those airports, so they're having their staffing cut and then they're having their workload increased, the traffic that would go in and out of those airports, depending on the rules of those carriers and those operators, will now shift into the other airports. So you've got almost a triple whammy because you've got the workload increasing, the staffing cutting, and the traffic volume moving off of the small airports into the other facilities where they are still open.
I don't want to be an alarmist here, Dan, but, you know, I don't want to be pushing the panic button. The end of the world is not coming if this happens. It's going to mean, as you've said, longer lines. It's going to mean less service. The safety will still be there, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's our bottom line is, you know, the air traffic controller workforce is to maintain the safety envelope. So as I said, it's just a matter of ratcheting it down as far as we have to maintain that level of safety, because that's the bottom line.
And this is, in my view, something that should not happen. It's something that doesn't have to happen. And if it does happen, it's by choice.
That appears to be the case, yes. I would agree with you, Rick.
Because, you know, I go back to this frame, and I don't think it's a tired frame. You hear people saying, well, we need to operate like a business. We need, and I heard a lot during the election about business needing certainty, yet everything for the last 2 years has really been uncertain. There have been times where the money needed to operate basic functions like air traffic controllers, like our highway system, like a lot of things, has been uncertain and has been held hostage. And I'm hoping at some point that we say enough is enough already.
Well, I certainly agree with you on that. And you know, while it's not as dramatic as the imminent impact to the direct operation of the air traffic control system, you've also got the ancillary things that nobody considers, which will really be the first things to go when you have to affect the system this negatively, and that's the training of replacements, because you cannot provide training to new employees who are, you know, they're always taking the place of the people who are tritting out through retirements or whatever other factors cause that. So that would be the first thing to go. And then the research and development, which has been a priority even amongst most members of Congress to move the air traffic system into the next generation, would immediately come to a halt, which would essentially set back development, you know, for that system, which is designed to improve and keep the United States competitive and all of those things. So those would be the first things to go right off the bat.
So again, what suffers? Investment in our future. And I've been saying that for the longest time. What we've seen is a walking away from what my kids are going to inherit and what their children are going to inherit.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. It's just there isn't a good way to – this is certainly not the way to deal with the air traffic control system, that's for sure. I don't know about – I'm not an expert on anything else. But for this system in particular, it's dangerous because it's unknown and you don't know what you're going to create.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of the agencies, and when you start going down this path of uncertainty, you don't know what's going to happen. And what I think is interesting is a lot of people that when this whole thing came up, they thought that the cuts were just to those people. You know, those welfare people and those food stamp people, those people. And then they realize, hey, wait a second. There's actually things that are going to affect me in this. Core functions of government, the air traffic controllers, cops, firefighters, education, down the list, hundreds and hundreds of things. But I thought it was just about those poor people until they realize it's going to bite all of us in the behind.
Yes, that's certainly a fact, Rick.
So what advice, last question, what advice do we give people? Are you guys working on anything? Friday's the deadline. What do we do?
Well, you know, whether you want to term it as fortunately or not, we have a collective bargaining agreement which requires the agency to give the employees at least 30 days notice of intent to furlough. So there won't be a direct effect until near the beginning of April if furloughs go forward. So I guess that's the one piece of good news is we have a little bit of time before that actually happens. During that time, there would obviously be the planning stages of how, you know, the system's going to operate, how the employees are going to be furloughed. And you know, that's the human element. I mean, these are hardworking, professional, dedicated people, and the people that support the system don't deserve to be treated like this either, and thrown into the lurch with their, you know, their salaries, their welfare, their families, over this kind of a battle. That's the other piece of it, I think, that's lost, is that not only are you affecting the operation of government, you're also, you know, treating people like chattel, as if they don't even matter, as if they don't have families, they don't have bills to pay. It's as if they're just pawns on a chessboard.
Well, there are those who believe that what you do is not a real job because it's a public sector type job.
Yeah, I've heard that, and not one of them could sit in the chair of any air traffic controller and do the job that I've ever met either. But you know, that's the way of the world now, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that something happens tomorrow that this is averted. Because there's part of me that goes, you know, it's the shtick, it's the game, it's how things go. You know, we tick 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 down to the last second, just like TV. We have our heart beating and heart thumping moment, and oh, crisis averted until we create the next one. So there's hope.
Yes.
Don, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you, and best of luck.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Don Chapman, president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, the Philadelphia local, NATCA.org, the website. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Show, changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender. Buy the stuff you...
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Friday, Harrisburg Hilton, the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit, the largest gathering of progressive activists in Pennsylvania coming to Harrisburg. The Harrisburg Hilton, of course. David Cobb, national spokesperson for Move to Amend, will be here because, hey, corporations are not people. Of course, Raul Gajalva will be here talking about the Progressive Caucus. So much more. We'd love to see you also Saturday night, 7:30 to 10 p.m. At the Cornerstone Coffee House, 2133 Market Street, Camp Hill. There will be a protest music sing-along. 100,000 poets and musicians for change. More community, more coming together, more opportunity to get out of the house, off the couch, and meeting and talking to people. Good stuff. Look forward to seeing you. Interesting story out of Philadelphia today. I don't even know how to go about this. The Philadelphia School District has a list of demands for the teachers that just blows my mind. 13% pay cuts for people making over $55,000 a year. 13% increase in their health care for folks making that much. The spouses or domestic partners of employees are going to have to pay a large surcharge. They want to take the health and welfare fund away from the teachers, create their own. No more sabbaticals for teachers who've worked 20 years. No more of that. No more steps to, graduated salary increases. Sorry, done. No more elevated pay for teachers with master's degrees or master's plus 30 credits or doctorates or any of that. So you know what that means? That means the people who have master's degrees with 30 credits and doctorates, they're going to leave. But yeah, no, never mind that. No more bonuses for people who achieve the National Board of Certification. Fairly prestigious award. Something worth pursuing. Not in the Philadelphia. We don't want those people, evidently. And no more seniority, it appears, because layoffs and recalls will be the superintendent's discretion. And they would get only 7 days notice of either, which is significantly less than the current proposal. Longer work days. Get this, we're going to lengthen your work day, and then we're going to cut your pay. So on top of the longer day, you're going to have to do more, doing the bus stuff, doing lunch duty, doing, all kind of outside work. No extra pay, of course, because you got the pay cut as well. Wow. And teachers not allowed to leave the building during the workday without approval. So can't go to your car, can't go to lunch during your lunch, nothing, done. Nurses who are called in early, emergencies, whatever, no comp time, done, sorry. for free. Congratulations. Schools with more than 1,000 students, no more librarians, no more librarian assistants. Sorry, not going to do that. Counselors, done. Thing of the past. The caseloads that they've got, uncapped, so you can have as many as you want. It's wow, this is a recipe for destruction. There's nothing good about the education environment that this is creating. Not to mention, teachers are going to be assigned unlimited classes out of their subject area. So you've got a math professor who's now going to, a math teacher, who they're going to put into teaching history. Because, you know, it's like factory work. It's all just, you know, just, hey, it's just opening those little empty vessels and pouring stuff in. High school teachers will be assigned extra class without any pay, so doing more work, more time, more work, no pay. In fact, 13% pay cut. No limit on the amount of consecutive taught time during the school day. So you could have class from morning to night. No limit on that. Also, no limit on class size. Currently, there is a cap on the lower grades at 30, and for the upper grades, 33. That's done. We can have 100 kids in a class. We could be like Detroit, where they had 55 kindergartners in a kindergarten class, and the fire department had to come in and declare a fire code violation. That sounds like a good thing, doesn't it? Sounds wonderful. That's the kind of school district I'd want to move into. This sounds like somebody who really wants to keep their public schools in tip-top best shape, keeping the best people, doesn't it? Well, of course not. It doesn't, because they want to privatize it. So if they can screw this up, if they can destroy this, by easier to privatize. A couple of my other favorites. Teachers are no longer going to be able to use reasonable force to defend themselves. This blows my mind. Because you've got the NRA and the right-wing Republicans in this country saying, every teacher should have a gun. But the Philadelphia School District says, you can't use reasonable force to defend yourself. How's that going to work with the gun? I know. You'll have the gun. The kid will smack you, take the gun, shoot you. And when you raise your hand, it'll be your fault. Gotcha. I'm right there. All right. The district also is not going to provide copy machines. Nope, not going to be required to do that. Or a sufficient number of instructional manuals and textbooks. So the kids don't get books. Don't have to do it. Contract. No, don't worry about it. We'll think of something else. And a whole bunch of other beautiful stuff, like no more teachers' lounges, no more water fountains, no parking facilities, no desks for teachers, no designated room for speech and language staff. The list goes on. No privacy for counselors, no longer guaranteed, you know, don't worry about it. No telephone, no locked cabinets, none of that stuff. And the topper on the cherry on the ice cream. After giving up all of this, this is what the district wants. The district retains the right to subcontract, outsource, or assign the bargaining unit jobs any way they feel like it. Outsource teachers, temp secretaries, that's Craigslist. We could get teachers and tutors just like the Frontiers of Virtual Cyber Charter Schools. We can get them on Craigslist for pennies. We don't need those certified teachers. Nah. Craigslist. That's where we're going to go to teach the next generation. That, my friends, that's how you run a school district. Into the ground. Quick break. Back with Hour 3.
And make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Just days ahead of the $85 billion in automatic federal spending cuts that begin to kick in, labor unions, progressives, and Democrats are arguing for a more intelligent, targeted effort to balance revenues and government spending.
One of the first groups of people to really feel the sequester pain will be long-term unemployed workers, who will take a hit to their already inadequate unemployment checks. The biggest ripple effect will come from furloughed federal workers. As the Friday sequester deadline looms, Simpson-Bowles has once again come up with a budget-cutting plan that they are trying to spin as balanced. But the plan that Erskine-Bowles and former Senator Alan Simpson are advocating is a plan that, according to the AFL-CIO, tells working people to drop dead. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the commission that these two headed in 2010 pushed a budget blueprint that cut tax rates for corporations and the richest Americans while cutting Social Security benefits, shifting Medicare costs to individuals, taxed health insurance benefits, and cut federal worker pay benefits and jobs. The updated Simpson-Bowles plan, Trumka says, once again proposes cutting taxes for corporations and the rich and pays for it by cutting Social Security cost of living increases, taxing health benefits, and cutting federal employee health and retirement benefits. The AFL-CIO says for working people and our nation, the latest Simpson-Bowles plan is dead on arrival. Latino organizations have joined a global boycott against one of the world's largest hotel chains. Jesse Russell reports.
A boycott against Hyatt Hotels expanded this week with three major Hispanic civil rights groups pledging their support. The National Council of La Raza, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement have all pledged to not hold conventions or other special events at Hyatt Hotels that are being targeted by the boycott. The boycott is being led by Unite Here over allegations by workers of mistreatment, intimidation, and unsafe working conditions. The union claims that the global boycott, which was launched in July of 2012, has cost the company more than $27 million in lost business. Unite Here is asking the chain to adopt recommendations made by the U.S. government that would reduce the daily strain on housekeepers, to allow non-union Hyatt hotels to organize, and to sign off on a contract for thousands of workers, many of whom have been working without a contract for 3 years. Other organizations that have already pledged support for the boycott include the NFL Players Association, the National Organization of Women, Interfaith Worker Justice, and others.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW. To keep labor news on the air, join the Solidarity Circle at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Big news today, stocks surged as the Dow Jones Industrial set a new five-year high. And Jack Lew was confirmed as Treasury Secretary. Coincidence? I think not. They got their guy. A guy who has... In my view, been the Wall Street guy, the part of that swinging door, the Wall Street shuffle going on, going from the street to government regulatory bodies and back and forth and back and forth so that they all continue to have the control over this nation. And somehow we've got to block that. Somehow that needs to stop. But I'm not thrilled with the Lew confirmation or the nomination for that matter. But I've asked Ken Zinn, political director at the National Nurses United, nationalnursesunited.org, this is their website, to come talk to us. Ken, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So do you think it's a coincidence? Stocks up five-year high, Jack Lew confirmed, or is it just coincidental?
No, it's not a coincidence. Of course, Wall Street does have their guy in there, and they're pretty happy about that. But this is a continuation of policies that have been in place for the last 30 years.
You know, I talk to people who are fairly well-to-do, and you know, and a lot of folks who look at the Obama administration and the appointments that he's made, you know, as some radical socialist, some radical left-wing guy. But you know what? Corporate profits have never been better. The wealthy have never had it so good. The bonuses are back. The CEOs are fat and happy. It's me and it's my listeners. It's the people who work for a living. They're the ones who are getting the shaft in all of this.
That's right. In 2012, banks had their most profitable year since 2006, and Wall Street bonuses were up 8% to $20 billion last year. And banks saw their yearly profits total more than $141 billion, while the rest of us are barely scraping by.
Well, I guess we know where the recovery went, and it didn't go to you and me.
No, in fact, the recent studies have shown that between 2009 and 2011, the top 1% of earners saw their incomes increase by over 11%, while the incomes of the rest of us went down by 0.4%. So the recovery has really gone to the top 1%.
And you look at during that same period of time, the new before-tax income, 121% of new income during that period went to that top 1%. And you go, how's that possible? How's it possible 121% of the new income went just to that small fraction of people? Well, it's obvious. As you pointed out, the rest of us are falling that much further behind.
Yeah, and so we need government policies that address these imbalances and the great disparities of wealth. And, one of the proposals that we've been campaigning for across the country and really around the world is this tax called the Robin Hood tax.
And I understand in the UK they have this tax. In fact, the Center for American Progress just had one of the member of the British Parliament over to talk about what they want to do, and he said that he doesn't see any evidence that there would be a negative effect on economic growth. He said quite the opposite. If a tax, a transaction tax, a Tobin tax, a Robin Hood tax were to be put in place. In fact, he said you could raise revenue that would actually help promote growth and invest in job creation, which to me sounds like what we should be doing instead of having all of these created manufactured crises all the time.
Yeah, that's right. Well more than half of what's considered trading on the stock exchange is actually just a fancy word for casino gambling. 70% of the trades on the New York Stock Exchange, for example, are done by these high-frequency traders. The average stock on the stock exchange now is held for all of 22 seconds, right? So these are firms that program their computers through algorithms to trade on the microsecond. They buy, they sell, they buy, they sell. And after they program the computers, there's no human beings involved. And, on more than one occasion, the market has experienced what they call a flash crash,
right,
which is caused by these computer trades. And this is not a productive investment. This doesn't create jobs. This doesn't even provide capital for companies to invest in our economy. All it does is make a very few people really wealthy. And
it rigs the game.
Yeah, that's right. And so this Robin Hood tax would be a very small tax. It's 50 cents on a $100 trade of securities, or 10 cents on $100 in trade in bonds, and even less on derivatives and currency. There's a bill that's being reintroduced in this Congress by Congressman Keith Ellison from Minneapolis. He introduced it in the last session. And that small tax would raise up to $350 billion dollars every year. So if you look at all the things that are being discussed as a way to get revenue to ward off this sequestration and to meet human needs, or even to, as some people are talking about, the deficit, there's really no single source of revenue as big as this Robin Hood tax. We're talking $3 trillion over a 10-year period. Nothing else comes close to that. And yet, unfortunately, the Congress is not considering this in any serious way. And Mr. Liu just said this week, in answer to a question from Senator Orrin Hatch, that he opposes the Robin Hood tax. All the while, as you said, we had the European Tax Commissioner here. I was there to hear him and met him this week. Europe is moving ahead. They have 11 countries now that just decided to move forward on a Robin Hood tax. These are a whole wide variety of governments. Some are center-left, but some are center-right, like the German government or the Spanish government, because they all know they need revenues to be able to feed their people and to operate their governments. And it's time that the U.S. government woke up and said, yeah, we need to do this as well.
Yeah, and to be honest, I got, you know, the people who are the speculators, the people who are the gamblers, there's part of me that says they should be the one who pay the cost when they crash the economy. Because, you know, when those flashes happen, they're generally not the ones that are harmed. The people that are generally harmed in that are people like pension funds and folks who are actually investing. This short-term quick gamble, this quick turnaround, those are they're okay. It's people like my pension fund. It's people like us who get harmed.
That's right. It's absolutely true. And really, I mean, this tax will be a blip on their radar screen because they're awash in cash right now. They're sitting on well over $1 trillion in capital that they're just not using. They would just simply program this into the algorithm that they program their computers with. Meanwhile, you and I go to the store, we got to buy shoes for the kids, right? We pay a sales tax, right? If you buy $100 worth of sneakers for your kid, on average across the country, it's different in every state, of course, but on average, you're paying over 9% sales tax. That's $9 for $100 worth of shoes, whereas if you're a trader on Wall Street, you're paying no sales tax, zero. All we're proposing is not $9 on $100 worth of trades. We're proposing 50 cents, two quarters.
What do you say to the argument? Because someone brought this up to me the other day. Well, they'll just, they're not tied to the U.S. They could go somewhere else.
Well, what we're seeing is that with the European Tax Commissioner here is that everywhere else is doing it, right? So all the big stock markets around the world have either already adopted a similar tax. So, the Hong Kong exchange has the tax. The South Korean exchange in Seoul has a tax. The Paris Stock Exchange has the tax now. The German in Frankfurt has a tax. And even in London, although the British government's against this new tax, the British government has had a financial transaction tax since 1694. This is not a new idea, by the way.
We used to have one as well, as I remember.
We had one in this country from 1914 to 1966. So this notion that either it can't work or that it necessarily drives capital overseas has simply not been proven to be true. I mean, it's ahistorical. So it's certainly doable. We've done it before. It's an old idea. It just means that Wall Street has to give back a little bit in order to fund the human needs that are so desperate in this country.
I think of Winston Churchill who said, Americans always do the right thing after doing everything else first. And this is an example of doing everything else first. We have made those who are already fat and happy even more so, those who are well-heeled even more so, at the expense of folks who go to the cupboards and there's nothing there.
Yeah, that's right. And, now within a matter of a couple of days, we're going to face the sequestration, which, means serious cuts for real people. I just saw a figure that Pennsylvania is going to lose about $27 million this year alone in funding for primary and secondary education. Head Start is going to stop for 2,300 children in Pennsylvania this year alone because of the sequestration. Money for to fund for Social Security, for law enforcement, for child care, for health insurance, for immunizations for your kids, all that's being dried up. Why? Because Wall Street won't pay anything. We won't force Wall Street to pay anything. It just seems obscene to me.
It seems ludicrous, but the reality is the argument for sequestration by the right is it's only 3 cents. It's just 3 cents. You could cut 3 cents if you really wanted to, Ken. If you really had the commitment, you could cut 3 cents, right? I mean, that's the argument they're making. It's just 3 pennies. But when you start, you look at, I go back to when I was a kid, when the cupboards were empty, when I was a kid, you couldn't cut 3 more cents to me because I didn't have anything to begin with.
That's right. I mean, and people who are least able to afford it shouldn't be asked to pay more. In fact, what we have to do, again, is find money for the massive human needs that are already evident without the sequestration. The people who aren't getting health care, the people who are going hungry, the people who have lost their homes, who don't have jobs, right? That's happening even before the sequestration, and the sequestration is just going to make it worse.
What do you say? There's part of me that there's a part of me that thinks this stuff has to happen. They've made these bombs. This austerity bomb has been made. They want to see it go off. They don't care who they harm. There's part of me that says that it has to happen, that people have to be harmed, that their stomachs have to be empty before their heads get right, and that's the only way that we're going to organize our way out of this and get the people who are continually doing this to us out of office. I mean, I think of our governor who's failing to take the Medicaid expansion. 700,000 adults could be denied health care. You know, you look at all of the numbers, the hundreds of thousands of people kicked off of the SNAP program if this happens tomorrow night. Is this not an opportunity to reach out to people and say, you know what, we need to mobilize, organize, get in the streets and be angry and ticked off?
Yeah, it's an opportunity, and you know, I think the other thing is we've got to show people that there actually are answers to these questions. They're not unsolvable problems. You know, there are ways to solve these problems, and they're pretty fundamental. And so, you know, we've got to show that you know, there has been a massive theft going on for the last 30 years in this country, from the working class to you know, the very, very, very rich, the top 1%. And as we see that transfer of wealth, you know, if we talk about class war, that's been the class war. It's been a war on the poor and the working class. And we, you know, it's time to, you know, take that back and to get some equilibrium.
I agree. You know, you can use the Tea Party word, redistribution of wealth, because it's what we've seen the last 30 years, redistributed from my pocket to theirs.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. There has been a redistribution. It's just the wrong way.
So what do we do between now and tomorrow? What's the answer? And then the organizing that has to happen afterwards when their austerity bomb goes off.
Well, I mean, one of the things, of course, everyone needs to contact their member of Congress and their senators and the president, because the president needs to offer real solutions that will take care of these problems. And you know, one of the key demands that we're asking people to make is, why not a Robin Hood tax? Why not a financial transaction tax to make Wall Street pay, to give back what they took? And if people can start writing their member of Congress and sending those emails, you know, then Congress will be forced to do that, but we're also going to have to get in the streets. There's no doubt about that.
I'm right there with you. It's a shame that it has to come to that, but I believe that's the answer. Ken Zinn, political director, National Nurses United, nationalnursesunited.org, the website. Ken, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
Oh, 90% of the job. When you fit in, take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Oh, 90% of the job.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us.
first African American woman statue in the in Statuary Hall, and everybody was out from the speaker. I mean, Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi, everybody was there. You know, kiss makeup and show that we're all Americans. United around Rosa Parks.
Yeah, and there's no such thing as inequality between the races. And
the Voting Rights Act, you know, doesn't matter.
Yeah, and the study.
We now have a statue of Rosa Parks in the Capitol.
And we got a black guy in the White House, so everything is wonderful, right?
Right, Rosie.
But also, if you saw the study that just came out that said, well, I think it was something like, a study that shows the wealth gap between whites and African Americans has tripled in the last 25 years. Everything's perfect. The way things ought to be, according to some of my friends.
Just like, you know, well, there isn't that much difference between CEO pay and a regular group pay.
Yeah. Like at McDonald's, where you would only have to work a million hours for the guy at the fry cook to make what the CEO makes. Just a million hours? That's not much, right?
Right, exactly.
Just a million. Alan Ratner?
Very different than when I was growing up in the 50s, my friend.
Yeah, very, very much so. Alan, I always appreciate the time. Great talking with you.
Thank you.
Our good friend Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. In the plan we've defended from all things that are good.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU, financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU, financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555. Or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Earth, sky.
China's endangered wild pandas need bamboo to survive. But a study indicates that climate change will kill bamboo off in swaths.
Scientists from Michigan State University and the Chinese Academy of Sciences studied how Earth's changing climate might affect the most common species of bamboo, carpeting forest floors in the mountains of northwestern China. The area is prime panda habitat, home to about 275 wild pandas, or about 17% of the remaining wild population.
The scientists studied possible scenarios of climate change. They said even the most optimistic scenarios show that, by the end of the 21st century, bamboo die-offs would cause prime panda habitat to become inhospitable for pandas.
A panda's daily menu consists almost entirely of bamboo leaves, stems, and shoots. And bamboo is a vital part of forest ecosystems, an essential food and shelter for other wildlife as well.
But bamboo has an unusual reproductive cycle. The species studied by these scientists flower and reproduce only every 30 to 35 years. That fact limits the plant's abilities to adapt to changing climate and can spell disaster for a food supply.
The scientists who conducted this study said that looking at the climate's impact on bamboo can help us prepare for the challenges that pandas are likely to face in the future. Today's program was made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Don, there's a real difference between venture capitalism and vulture capitalism. The fact of the matter is that he's going to have to face up to this at some time or another.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go this weekend. Some interesting stuff, and I know I've been promoting it a lot because I think it's important. I think it's important to get out and to organize and meet people this weekend, the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit put on by the folks at Keystone Progress. They're going to be holding the largest gathering of progressive activists in Pennsylvania. This summit's going to be here in Harrisburg at the Hilton, right there on the corner of Market and 2nd Street. It'll start Friday at 4 o'clock with David Cobb. He is the national spokesperson for Move to Amend. They are the folks who are saying we need to amend the Constitution to define a person as a human being, flesh and blood, breathing, you know, able to die, not corporations. And I know the Romneys of the world, the wealth class, corporations are people. They're not. So it'll be interesting to hear David Cobb. Also, Raul Grijalva, the Democrat from Arizona, a member of the Progressive Caucus, going to be there to speak as well about what's going on in Congress. Also an opportunity to meet Kathleen Kane, the Attorney General, Eugene D. Pasquale, the Auditor General, and potentially the next governor, Rob McCord, the current Treasury Secretary, the current head of the Treasury there. So good stuff there. On Saturday night, there's going to be a protest music sing-along, 100,000 poets and musicians for change going to be holding their sing-along at the Cornerstone Coffee House, 2133 Market Street in Camp Hill. If you want any more information on either of those events, you can always email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, you go back to what Jake was talking about earlier with the school district saying, here are the keys. That's the plan. Right there in a nutshell. That's it. It doesn't get any simpler than that. They want to privatize. They want to profitize. They want to go after and destroy public education. Or as the extremists call it, government education. They want you to believe in government. You know, they want you to learn about your government. They want you to learn about your constitution. They want to learn about your... No, they don't want that. They want you to learn corporations are people. Corporations are God. Capitalism, wonderful. All of that stuff that you folks do for yourself, like educate your children and take care of fire and police, that bad, should be doing it for profit. And we're ticking down to the final days. Friday, the sequester austerity bomb is supposed to go off. And like I've been saying, I truly believe that the people who created this bomb, the people who voted for it, the people who are pushing to really not get anything done, they want to see their bomb go boom. Because why make a bomb? Why make a bomb if it doesn't go boom? That's the theory anyway. So the arsonists who are holding our country hostage, they want to see their handiwork. And I guess that's going to be somewhere late Friday evening. And I go back to that story we talked about at the beginning of the program. You know, this corrections officer alone by himself in a maximum security prison, putting away prisoners, brutally beaten, murdered, because he was there by himself. There should have been two, three, there should have been people there, but here again, it's the cuts, cuts, cuts. Sad stuff. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and adversary.